At Pluralsight, we don't just teach skills. We are building the tech workforce who deliver results fast, accelerated by top-tier content. Lead with confidence. Lead with expertise. Visit us at Pluralsight.com to tap in and learn more.
Due to the themes of this podcast, listener discretion is advised. Lock your doors. Close the blinds. Change your passwords. This is Secrets and Spies. Secrets and Spies is a podcast that dives into the world of espionage, terrorism, geopolitics, and intrigue. This episode is presented by Matt Fulton and produced by Chris Carr.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Secrets and Spies. The Atlantic's Shane Harris is back with us today. He recently returned from a reporting trip across Europe, talking with officials who are quietly preparing for a future where they may have to defend the continent without America's help. We get into what that means for NATO, how Trump's return has changed the conversation, and whether Europe's newfound confidence can last. Thanks for watching. Thanks for listening. Take care.
The opinions expressed by guests on Secrets and Spies do not necessarily represent those of the producers and sponsors of this podcast.
Shane Harris, welcome back on, my friends. Good to see
Matt,
you.
Matt, it's great to see you. Always nice to be here. Thanks again for having me.
Of course. So you, the occasion this time, you had a piece out recently in The Atlantic recounting a recent trip to Europe where you talked to a bunch of officials over there and get their sense of everything. So I thought we'd have a little bit of a debrief. Mm-hmm. Before we get into the details on that, though, what struck you most about the atmosphere on the ground when you were over there? Did it feel like a region finally confident in its own defense or one bracing for a war they aren't prepared to fight?
Well, I think that they feel confident that they are increasing their defenses. And certainly you hear when you talk to officials, particularly in countries that have agreed to increase their spending on defense, these are NATO allies, to a higher portion of GDP, trying to hit that 5% target that Trump has set. They feel very good about doing that, and they feel that it's extremely necessary, for two reasons, which kind of gets to your question. One is, and this has been true since Russia invaded Ukraine 3 years ago now, that they feel that Russian aggression is a direct threat to their sovereignty. They take this war in Ukraine as more of an existential matter. It's something that Americans don't often kind of quite, understand, I think, because this is, a war that is on their doorstep in some cases, particularly, you're talking about Estonia, Poland. The Brits also feel this as well. So they feel that, this is, necessary, this increase in defense spending to fight a potential war with Russia. And they don't have any, illusions about, Putin's aims there. I mean, they don't think he would just stop with Ukraine, putting aside how the war in Ukraine ends. The second thing, and this was the really, I think, more kind of acute and alarming piece, is that they're not counting on the United States. I mean, it is very clear in my conversations with officials, with, experts, people in the security communities in these countries that, they're not convinced that Donald Trump is going to walk away from NATO tomorrow, although there are scenarios in which NATO might just break and not work anymore. But they're not planning for a future defense where the United States is this sort of indispensable ally that they can always rely on. They're planning for a future in which, the United States is not that reliable partner. And that was pretty striking. And I think that their feeling is that it's not just something that's unique to Trump. I mean, I think they see populist strains rising in the United States and both parts of this political spectrum, by the way, although it's more been a feature of the political right, obviously, in the United States for the past few years. But they see the United States just generally kind of withdrawing in ways that tell them, we need to plan for a possibility that, we may have to carry a lot more of the burden for ourselves. And that was pretty striking. They seem quite clear-eyed and obviously disappointed about that, too.
Mm-hmm. A lot of your piece talks about the Europeans' response to the recent drone incursions over Denmark, coming from parts of the Baltic into Poland from the Russians through Ukrainian airspace. And they were quite sort of confident in how they responded to that. Do you think when it's the European themselves pulling the trigger against these incursions, does that carry a different message for Putin? Do you think he reads a European military response as more threatening than the U.S. swooping in to save them again?
Well, I would suspect he probably doesn't see it as, you know, much of a threat as, you know, the United States, which has the superior technology, obviously. But I think that the Europeans want him to read it as a message, which is that, you know, we are fully capable of defending ourselves. We will do so. We know what you're doing. You know, we have the capability. And, you know, and I think that you can, that the Polish foreign minister said that pretty explicitly, you know, Radek Sikorski, when he was speaking at to the UN Security Council. I mean, his remarks are worth going back and reading, and I link to them in the piece, where he just says directly to the Russians, don't come crying to us if one of your aircraft strays into accidentally, he made a big point of like laughing at the notion that it was an accident, into Polish airspace. Don't come whining when we shoot it down. And I think that that was meant clearly. I mean, it was explicit to the Russians to say, like, we have the capability to do so. I mean, now, notably, there were, you know, they only shot down about four drones that came in because, you know, the Poles were, you know, there were aircraft flying against those drones and not missiles and missile defense packages going against them, which is what Sikorsky's been advocating for, a kind of a drone shield that would be more like a, you know, how we think of like a Patriot missile defense system, you know, something that shoots up, or like Iron Dome that shoots things out of the sky. So they're actually going, they're sending up planes to shoot these things down, which is not a great use of resources.
No.
But it sends a message, and they want to send that very clearly.
You also write a lot about their sense that these incursions actually backfired on the Russians. I mean, you mentioned the Operation Eastern Sentry, the sort of bolstered air defenses on the eastern flank, the sort of drone wall. I guess why do they feel that those incursions backfired on the Russians now?
I think that the officials I spoke to and the experts I talked to, you know, think that Russia is in part doing these incursions because it's trying to divide the alliance, and it's trying to obviously split the United States off from the NATO allies in Europe. And they felt that is not happening. At least it's not now. And we should always just caveat this by saying that, like, Donald Trump could change his mind tomorrow. And in fact, he did seem to switch his position on Russia and Ukraine the day after my story published. And then a couple of days later, he seemed to switch back in terms of, like, you know, whose side are you on here? I mean, I'm speaking very broadly in that way. Mm-hmm. But he's taken so many different positions that, you know, I think that the NATO allies, you know, obviously look at him and say, like, you know, he's not consistent in his support for us. But for the moment, you know, he seems to be on sides with us. And so they were reading, I think, to some degree, the Russian incursions as a backfiring in that they did not, you know, it didn't result in Donald Trump coming out and saying, you know, this terrible war in Ukraine is just caused this. That's why this is all such a mess in Europe. And that's what these incursions are. He's not coming out and, you know, praising Putin for violating the sovereign airspace of NATO allies. In fact, he's saying the opposite. He's saying, you know, that it's not a good thing, which, again, you would hope for a more forceful response from an American president. But for Trump, I think that they see him coming out in support of the allies and not exactly condemning these violations of airspace, but saying, you know, that the NATO allies have a right to defend themselves. They consider that a win, given what they're dealing with,
mm-hmm.
or who they're dealing with.
Yeah. To that point, how do you think European leaders are handling their relationship with Trump right now compared to the first term?
It's so interesting. Some colleagues of mine wrote a piece, you know, around this earlier in the year. It's almost as if, like, every major European leader has kind of figured out what is the special sauce that they have that helps them work with Trump and get more of an in to him directly? Because what they all want is a personal connection with him. That's very important. For the French, you know, it is the sort of the splendor of France and the Versailles-ness of it. That so when he comes over, I mean, they've kind of, you know, brought out all the bells and whistles. He loves that. For the Brits, who, you know, Keir Starmer, the prime minister, and he openly are very affectionate to one another and both say they have such a great relationship. that may be partly Starmer's flattering him. I'm sure it's also doing things like showing up with a letter from the king for the president. He likes that. Yeah. The Finnish president is a really good golf player, and they play golf together. So it's almost like every one of these leaders is trying to kind of find what's the in, and, you know, and then sort of sharing that information that they're gathering, you know, with each other. I was at a conference in Estonia earlier in the year, and they were kind of, you know, talking around this, but all sort of hinting at the fact, a number of these world leaders, that, yeah, you know, we all kind of like figure out what we can from them. We sort of then share it with each other. We talk. And I think that they have just realized that you have to have personal relationships with him, and that they might be transactional, because Trump is, you know, he's not a multilateralist. He's not saying, you know, like NATO is the bedrock of our relationships. He's saying my relationship with your country is based on my relationship with you, you individual leader.
Yeah, it's entirely personal and
yes, and
transactional, and it's just a game you unfortunately have to play, at least from their perspective. Someone who's done a really interesting approach to that, that stood out to me at least, is the new-ish Secretary General of NATO, Mark Rutte, former Dutch Prime Minister. Trump, of course, posted this screenshot of a text message from him while Trump was on his way to the last NATO summit, like just fawning, you know, congratulations on like your biggest victory ever. Like, this is all for you. Like, we got the defense spending up. Very kind of, for a lot of people, I think, eye roll inducing and just, you know, like, please don't debase yourself. But I looked at it and I see that, and I'm like, you know what, Putin and all these bad guys sort of manipulate him for evil all the time. So why not manipulate him for good in this case? I don't know if you've gotten that sense of how that relationship is working and how that's maybe holding the alliance together somewhat.
Yeah, this is Rutte, you know, famously calling him daddy.
Yeah.
And it's a bit, you know, it's so over the top and it's cringy, but it might be working, right? And you would think, right, that Trump, it's not that Trump is unaware, by the way, that, you know, all these leaders, I think he's even used the phrase before, you know, they're all kissing my ass.
Mm-hmm.
He knows they're doing it. And I think that's fine with him. And I think it's both because he is so susceptible to flattery, but also it's a transaction. He wants to get things from them. And, you know, he does see getting more NATO countries to that 5% GDP goal. There's some, you know, funny math in there, but significant more increase in spending. He sees that as a result of his strong arming, right? And NATO members go out of their way to credit him with it too, which is another way of them saying, like, you know, you're so strong and you're so powerful. Now, many of them will also say, we should have been doing this a long time ago, and he's not wrong. Yeah. And other American presidents have also pressured alliance members to spend more. You know, I mean, I guess it's like, I think that, you know, most people I talk to, they do kind of roll their eyes at the Rutte comment and saying it's a bit over the top. At the same time, I don't hear anybody saying, like, this is completely unnecessary either. This is sort of like the bargain that they've struck. And some of them are more, you know, obsequious, I guess, than others. And, you know, but nobody is, you know, you don't really see, I'm trying to think if there's like there's not really like a NATO member that's out there as like being the foil to Trump.
Spain, maybe.
Yeah, maybe. But I mean, there too, like the spending is not that high. And so, you know, I mean, I'm sure that these leaders would rather not see the Secretary General, you know, tripping all over himself to praise, you know, President Trump. But it seems to be working largely in the sense, right, that the United States has not obviously abandoned NATO, but also that there does still seem to be this moment of opportunity for keeping Trump on side with the allies when it comes to Ukraine. And what they don't want to see is, you know, him turn his back on Ukraine or sell out Ukraine to Russia. And if that's kind of keeping things, you know, tenuously together, then I suppose that they just have to live with it.
What do you think Pete Hegseth's role in all this has been? I mean, he seems to be more concerned with extracurriculars and stuff than, you know, the meat and potatoes of these relationships. Just wondering how much of a factor he's been in all this.
I don't think he has been a really big factor. I mean, you don't hear about or see Hegseth getting deeply involved in policy, and certainly not, you know, international policy, allied relationships. That's really been more Marco Rubio's area. And there you do hear from foreign leaders and foreign officials who say that they, you know, they interact with Rubio quite a lot, and they're glad to, because they feel that, you know, he's a sophisticated thinker, or certainly, you know, they see him as one of the more, I guess, figures committed to these traditional goals and alliances in the administration, which is not to say that he's somehow on a different page than the president. He's very much aligned with the president, but he's somebody who they feel they can deal with. And you just don't hear Hegseth popping up in those conversations.
To that point, I find it interesting that Rubio was one of the sponsors of the bill during Biden's term that was passed to require Senate approval for the U.S. to withdraw from NATO.
Yeah. And was also part of the push to get Machado, the Venezuelan opposition leader, the Nobel Prize, which, you know, Donald Trump wanted. yeah, I mean, it's like there are so many ways in which, I mean, Rubio is such a fascinating figure in this administration, because there are so many things that he has stood for and talked about in his previous life as a senator and a presidential candidate that are not really neatly aligned with Trumpism and that foreign policy. And yet he has made himself one of the more valuable players in the administration. I mean, when you talk to administration officials, they seem really thrilled with Rubio. The White House seems to love him. He's doing like, what, six jobs now? I mean, he's kind of like the Energizer Bunny in this administration. And I think obviously has presidential ambitions. I mean, he's run for president before, but I don't think they've abated. So, you know, I mean, he's doing some things that are, you know, clearly not aligned with what he said in the past. And then he's doing some things that seem quite aligned. I mean, you know, I think you can read what's going on in Venezuela with, you know, both the shooting up of the drug boats and the possible military action to unseat Maduro. I think you can read that as Rubio's war.
Oh, that's
in
him.
A way.
That's 100% him.
That's him, right? Yeah. And he's driving that foreign policy. And Trump doesn't do policy. Trump doesn't have a strategy. You know, to the extent that he has a view of the world, it's being largely shaped, I think, by probably people like Rubio, and a sense that he, I think, I'm kind of projecting into both how I think he thinks, but also what we see happening, that Trump sort of sees the world more as these kinds of spheres of influence. And he sees a world in which China has sort of its role, Russia has a role, and we have a role. And he is pursuing a strategy that's much more geared around our hemispheric interests, you know, wanting to talk of making Canada the 51st straight, say, trade war with Canada, talk about acquiring Greenland, activity in the Caribbean, counter-narcotics efforts, you know, possibly unseating governments in South America. I mean, he seems more concerned right now with things in our own backyard and in trying to stabilize relationships with China and Russia, but not, you know, you're not, Donald Trump is not going to go out there beating the drum for spreading democracy, you know, through the global South or something, like some huge ambitious project that you might expect an American president you know, who believes in multilateral alliances and the U.S. as a world force for leadership in the world might do. I don't think that's how he views things. And he thinks that we've been taken advantage of for a long time, and we've been ignoring things at home in favor of people abroad.
Let's take a break and we'll be right back.
Extra Value Meals are back. For just $5, get a savory and sweet sausage, egg, and cheese McGriddles, plus hash browns and a coffee. Only at McDonald's.
For limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher in Hawaii, Alaska, and California, and for delivery.
So countries like Poland and Germany are pouring a lot of money into their defense production now. Olaf Scholz calls this the Zeitenwende. That kind of, you know, spending eventually collides with domestic politics, Europe's social safety net, their programs to that effect. Are leaders worried that this buildup just isn't sustainable if a deal in Ukraine is reached and the immediate fear of Russia subsides?
You know, in talking to people in Europe, it's interesting. I'm sure they must, and I'm sure on the domestic political level there's much more debate about this, but you hear a lot of people saying it's great that we're spending all this money, but not talking necessarily about how they're going to pay for it.
Uh-huh.
And understanding that, maybe that's because they just know that they have to and they have the capacity and they'll raise the money somehow for all these other programs. But, you know, it's obviously a strain on budgets. Interestingly, I mean, I think that what they also see, though, is an opportunity here, and maybe this is not what Trump had in mind, is to start building up their own defense industrial base. I think many of these countries would probably prefer to be buying European weapon systems rather than Americans if they were good enough, because why not keep the jobs in Europe? And why not, boost their own economy that way? They're in a position now that they're not accustomed to spending, these countries, to spending this much on the military. And, it's kind of maybe hard for Americans to kind of to fathom this, but, you take a country like Denmark, for instance. If Donald Trump decided tomorrow that we're going to annex Greenland, and we're just going to take it, he wouldn't even really have to take it by force because there's nothing that the Danish military could do to stop him.
No.
They don't have the capability. Even when there were the drones flying over, the MiG fighters, the Russian MiGs flying over Estonia. I mean, those were NATO jets on patrol from the Italian Air Force that intercepted them. That was because it was Italy's turn in the rotation to be doing air patrol. But all these countries kind of depend on one another to a degree because many of them just don't have any kind of indigenous capability. So to be spending this kind of money on this is like, because we're going back in almost like a Cold War kind of mentality. I'm not even sure they spent that much on the Cold War. So this is a real, change in how they think about, what the priorities are for their countries. And that I presume is going to run up against social policy at some point, and probably already on the domestic level, probably is in some places.
Macron has talked about extending France's nuclear umbrella over Europe as a more independent deterrent. I believe he discussed this with Germany recently. At this point, do you know if that's a serious idea or just more aspirational? Are they putting stuff in place to do that?
I don't know. I'm not sure about that. It's interesting. This isn't quite your question, but Trump just yesterday, before his meeting with Xi Jinping, said he wants to start, U.S. Nuclear weapons testing again.
It's a lot of factual issues with how he announced that, but yeah.
Yeah. But it's sort of, I wonder, I'm not sure that Trump would necessarily be opposed to countries extending the nuclear umbrella that way. It's not something, I guess, that we've had to contemplate. But the fact that, European countries are doing so openly, I think, is pretty illustrative of what we were talking about in the beginning, that they're not counting on the United States as the stabilizing force that it has been. They are planning for a future in which that relationship is different. How different, how altered, depends on, I guess, who's in the White House. But, I think it just kind of goes again to the threat they see from Russia and the way that they feel that they cannot count as deeply on the United States as they have for decades.
Mm-hmm. And we've also seen since your piece was published, of course, you noted there was this rapid flip flop with Trump's posture toward Ukraine, as soon as it came out. So since then, we've seen these coordinated U.S. and European sanctions on Russia's oil industry, while Trump has declined to send Tomahawk missiles to Ukraine. His meeting with Putin in Budapest isn't happening now. Not sure what happened there. How's that being read over there? Have you heard?
I haven't had a chance to talk with anybody about precisely all those kind of machinations. But in the broad sense, what they are trying to do, what Europeans are trying to do, is ensure that the United States does not pressure Ukraine into taking a bad deal. For years, talking to folks about the war in Ukraine, nobody, that I know thinks that Russia is going to be entirely expelled from Ukraine. There may have been a moment that if the NATO countries and if the United States had committed more forcefully to repelling the Russians, that maybe they could have kicked them out, maybe even save Crimea. But nobody's thinking about it in those terms. It's always been about we're going to arrive at a settlement somehow. What does that look like? And I think that what everyone is, you know, what the NATO members are trying to do is keep Trump from striking a deal like, you know, give Russia the whole of the Donbass, which Ukraine obviously finds unacceptable and won't do. So that's one. And the other component of this is they're clearly preparing for the possibility and maybe even the likelihood that they will have to pick up the slack from U.S. weapons provisions and assistance to the Ukrainians. I mean, Trump has said, you know, we're not going to give any more weapons. We'll happily sell them, but we're not giving them anymore to Ukraine. So I think the Europeans see a bigger role for themselves in, you know, providing for Ukraine's defense. That doesn't necessarily get you to a settlement. So, you know, what would the ideal settlement look like? I don't know. But I mean, it's clearly not the ones that, you know, Trump has been floating with, like, let's have a ceasefire. I mean, he's been pretty good at echoing Russian talking points up until now. And you know, the Ukrainians and the Europeans seem to have maybe been doing a good job of getting him to back down from that. But like, he just vacillates back and forth so much that it's really hard to keep track of where he is on a given day.
Do you think with Ukraine itself and the war coming up? Yeah, we're well into its third year now. Do you see any sort of genuine end in sight? I mean, there have been moments in the past recently where it felt like we might be nearing a turning point, maybe the beginning of the end. But now I really have no idea. What's your sense of that?
I don't think so. I mean, I don't hear anyone talking in near terms. I mean, they're talking about, you know, 2026 and what needs to happen to, you know, bolster Ukraine. And, you know, and that's why people are getting excited about the Tomahawks, right? Is, you know, okay, so maybe we give, you know, Ukraine to the ability to pressure Russia even more with deeper strikes. But there too, that's not going to fundamentally change, you know, the fact that Russian troops are in Ukraine and Ukraine can't push them out. I mean, maybe about 8 months ago, I was listening to a senior Western official say, you know, it's Russia and Ukraine are both losing here. It's a question of who's losing more quickly. And I think that sort of gives you a sense of this kind of, maybe not stalemate's too strong a word, but that there's not fundamentally anything that's shifting the momentum towards Ukraine or to Russia. And so we're just kind of stuck in this now going into 2026. You know, does Putin want a deal? I mean, he says he does. Does he seem willing to keep feeding troops into a meat grinder? Yeah. Now, if he had to do a general conscription and suddenly, you know, it's the sons of well-to-do families in Moscow and, you know, the sort of middle class of Russia, as opposed to soldiers from the hinterlands, so to speak, that are the ones being called up, maybe public attitudes would change. But that doesn't seem to be happening either. So it seems like we're heading in for more of the same. And what Trump would obviously like to happen is for, you know, both his friend Vladimir Putin to like do him a solid and end this, but also, you know, Ukraine to just go along with it. I mean, there was this report from his last meeting with Zelensky in the White House, which wasn't on camera, like that famous blow up with him advance. Yeah. But from reports, it sounds like it was equally contentious, with Zelensky showing him maps with troop positions and all that, and reportedly Trump taking the maps and throwing them and saying, you know, F the maps, you know, you need to make a deal. Trump has managed to keep that temper a little cooler publicly, but I think, you know, that probably gives you a sense of how just thin his patience is at this point, and that he does not see the sovereignty of Ukraine as the mission here. That's not what he's after.
So you think years, not months, left to go?
I would hesitate to make a prediction on that, but I don't see it happening in months. But then again, I mean, look, I mean, who knows? I mean, this is just, I mean, it's just, I mean, he, you know, it's, Trump has taken so many different positions just in the past couple of weeks. And, you know, you could debate whether or not providing Tomahawks would make it be a game changer in the war. Maybe it wouldn't. But the fact that he kind of openly flirts with, well, maybe I'll give more weapons, it just kind of tells you that I'm not sure you can really bet, you know, with time specifics on what's likely to happen. But, you know, he has often said to Zelensky, you don't have any cards to play, or you don't hold any cards. And Trump has a lot of cards. I mean, there's a lot that he could do.
Yeah, for sure. You know, I think overall, to me at least, I think your piece strikes a note of cautious optimism, which is in a way, I think, why I was drawn to it and wanted to talk to you about it. You know, Europe's response has been impressive, I think, but the real test is whether it lasts. After this trip over there, talking to everyone that you talk to, are you more confident or more skeptical that over the long term, NATO can meet the moment, whether that's with Ukraine and Russia or with Trump himself?
I mean, I think I'm more confident. And, and it's what, you know, and, you know, it's both in terms of just the actions you're seeing them take, but also, you know, the confidence in the way that they talk. I mean, I interviewed the Estonian prime minister and, you know, he probably said 10 times NATO is working. NATO is working. And I mean, I think you could make an argument that that's right. I mean, it is doing what it should be doing right now. I mean, it's not perfect. You know, I didn't put this in the piece, but, you know, there was some reporting that when Estonia wanted to invoke Article 4, which is not quite the mutual self-defense part, Article 5 that people are more familiar with, but essentially would force NATO to come together and do a meeting and decide what to do about the MiG jet incursions. There have been reporting that Rutte had privately, you know, and Prime Minister of Estonia were fighting about this. And Rutte was basically saying, you can't just, you know, call Article 4 every time something like this happens. It's going to dilute the power of that. And Michael, the Prime Minister, told me was that he said those reports aren't accurate. You know, we didn't have this fight. And at the end of the day, I mean, they did declare Article 4 and they came together and they met and they beefed up the presence. So, you know, the people who are in favor of being more aggressive with Russia, of flexing NATO's muscle, are the ones who right now are kind of ahead. I mean, it's Sikorsky in the UN. It's the prime minister in Estonia. It's, you know, people who are kind of leaning in, to use that phrase, to the power of NATO and trying to maybe, you know, show the president that, you know, hey, there's a way forward here. Like, this thing has worked for, you know, and we need you to be a part of it. You know, this alliance is strong. So that was heartening. I mean, you know, but I mean, I feel like my overall mood just generally right now is pessimistic when it comes to the U.S.'s role in the world.
Fair.
But it's like a shade less pessimistic after that trip. I'm also well aware that this could shift and like my pessimism meter could go all the way, you know, to the max at any moment. But it was heartening to hear this. And, you know, and that's one of the reasons why I wanted to write the story.
Oh, that's good to know. Yeah, definitely why I wanted to talk to you about it here. I know you got to go soon. Anything else you'd like to cover that we haven't gotten to?
No, I mean, I think it's just, you know, another thing I would just flag for listeners in terms of, you know, European security and the NATO alliance is don't forget about Greenland. I mean, Greenland has been in the news off and on with Donald Trump talking about wanting to acquire it and how, you know, we need it for international security. For our own security, which I think is kind of a hollow argument. But, you know, there are rare earth minerals in Greenland that he might like to have. I do think he would like to expand the physical territory of the United States at some point in his last term in office here. You know, so that is still very much on the table. There's a newly confirmed U.S. ambassador who's taken up his post in Copenhagen. The Danes are very well. I mean, I talked to a lot of people in Denmark about Greenland, and they are nervous that, you know, once Trump is kind of, as they put it, like done with dealing with Gaza and Ukraine, is he going to somehow now turn his attention back to Greenland? So, you know, don't sleep on that, because if Trump decided to, you know, forcibly take Greenland and effectively make it part of the United States, I think you could argue in that moment NATO would cease to exist, because, you know, one member state can't seize the territory of another. Unless are the other member NATO members going to send troops to Greenland to defend it? I doubt it. So that would be a historic turning point if that happens.
I agree. I think, I think that's probably where those personal relationships with European leaders come really in handy.
Yes. Yes. And I would imagine that, you know, is If that starts to heat up again, then, you know, expect to, you know, maybe you'll start seeing European leaders suddenly flying over to Washington to go golfing with the president.
And I can't imagine Rubio doesn't see the insanity in just that proposal of taking Greenland. I mean, whatever. Yes, there are real U.S. security interests in Greenland. And can we bolster our defenses and our presence there? Yes, you don't need to annex it by force to achieve those things.
No, not at all. In fact, most people I talked to in Denmark made a point, just unprompted, of saying, like, look, if it's more bases that, you know, the president wants, have them. We'll help you build them.
Yeah.
Great. We have security agreements with Denmark now that allow us to do that. And then we do have the space base, you know, kind of up above the circle, which is really about, about missile defense and, you know, watching for those things coming from Russia. But, you know, I don't think it's about security. I think that's not what, you know, why the president wants it. I think he looks at a map and sees this big chunk of territory next to Canada that is part of North America and says, why don't we have that? Why does Denmark have that?
It's very Stalinistic.
What's Denmark? Yeah. Well, yeah. Here we are. So, yeah. So keep your eyes on Greenland.
We'll do. We'll do. All right. Well, thank you, sir. Always good
to talk to you,
to
Matt.
You.
Thanks for having me.
Yep.
Okay. Talk
soon.
Bye-bye. Bye.
Listening. This is Secrets and Spies.